Good afternoon and welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter, filling in for Al Cresta. My guest, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News, Senior Fellow at St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology, and author or co-author of more than 50 books, including the first English language biography of Pope Francis and the Encyclopedia of Catholic History. You can follow him on Twitter at Matt Bunsen, and he also voices Register Radio, which airs Saturdays at 4 p.m. and Sundays at 11 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio. Matthew, how are you doing?
I'm very well. How are you?
Very well, thank you. So my sources tell me that you just returned from the part of the world that I come from, and in fact, very close. Are you in Singapore?
Yes, I was in Singapore for almost 10 days. I go there from time to time, especially because my wife has family there. And in this case, we were attending a family wedding for one of her cousins, and also had an opportunity to spend some time with some of the Catholic leaders in Singapore, in particular Cardinal William Goh. Hopefully we'll have a lot more to say about that in the coming days. But it's a joy always for me to go to Singapore, aside from its fascinating history, its dazzling culinary masterpieces that you can find everywhere, but also the vibrance of the Catholic faith in the country to me is very striking. And it's also sort of a testament to the rise of Catholicism and Christianity in general in Asia, which I think is something we really want to be paying attention to.
Right. When I was in Singapore, I went to, did 2 years of seminary in Singapore, and at that point he was Father William Goh, and he was the rector at the seminary, and he was named bishop and now cardinal. So it's been quite the journey, and it's been very heartening for me to watch the Lord use him so mightily for the sake of the faith in Singapore. This might be too much to say, but he is one of the main reasons why the faith is as vibrant as it is in the country. But that's probably attributing way too much to him, you might think, but I personally think so.
Having gotten to know him a little bit, I suspect he would probably argue that it was a lot of other people, starting, of course, with our Lord.
Yep.
No, I think you're absolutely right that you can see the zeal, the fervor, but also the real sense of mission and purpose and also organization in the church there, in that archdiocese in Singapore. And I think it's one of the reasons why Pope Francis has made the decision to become only the second pope to visit Singapore. Pope John Paul II did it, I think, in 1986, and that was for a grand total of 5 hours. I said Mass, which everyone, when you talk to them who was around at the time, remembers it very vividly. But this is going to be part of Pope Francis's scheduled trip. We're certainly hoping that the Holy Father will be up to taking it in September. The first few days in September, he'll be heading to that part of the world. So a visit to Indonesia, I believe Jakarta in particular, Papua New Guinea, and then East Timor, and then finishing up, I believe, in Singapore, I think for 1 or 2 days, which is going to be quite the event for the Singaporean Catholics. I know all of the ones that I've talked to are very excited about the possibility of Pope Francis coming.
Right,
but
I imagine so, yeah.
Understands, of course, that we'll see how his health goes.
I love how Malaysia isn't on that list.
Well, Indonesia, I think, there was a very interesting interview, I think with Cardinal Soeharto, about the Pope's trip to Indonesia, and it is, I believe, statistically the largest Muslim country in the world.
Yep.
And similar to Singapore, it's kind of a crossroads of interreligious dialogue. One of the things that is really striking about Singapore, a couple of things. One is the way that religious tolerance is enshrined in its constitution.
That's right.
Which is an important statement to make. And then also the degree of familiarity and comfort and even friendship that exists among what is a very multi-ethnic and multi-religious culture. That is one of the things that is always striking to me when I spend any time in Singapore, how determined they are to get along, but how naturally they get along.
That's right. It's ingrained in the culture. There's not even a semblance of unrest in the societal framework. Now, granted, it's an island nation, so one might argue that administrating an island nation and maintaining the peace there is not that tall an order. But it's still a remarkable feat, because true religious harmony, if you will, amongst the other faiths really does exist in Singapore.
Yes, yeah. And you can see as well the way that it has often been said that Singapore is the first and best gateway. If you have never been to Asia before, go start with Singapore, because it is such an easy introduction to the richness of Asia. English is essentially the primary language, mm-hmm. as you know, better than I would. So it's accessible, for example, for Americans to visit there. But it's also, I think, because it is so well run, because it is so deliberately multicultural and very pluralistic, but not in the way that we think of multiculturalism now, unfortunately, in the United States and
right.
Western Europe.
Right.
It is a genuine blending and beautiful tapestry of different religious and ethnic communities, all working side by side with each other. And to walk the streets of Singapore is to see Asia in all of its diversity. And in that sense, too, I think there's a lesson for us in the West of what it means to have authentic diversity and authentic, we use the term equity now, but I think equality under the law and inclusion, because any major event brings so many different people from so many different backgrounds in Singapore together.
One of the main reasons why this is the case, too, is unlike the other Asian nations, Malaysia, but in an even greater regard, Singapore, is heavily influenced by the heritage of Western civilization and Western thought. And it's ingrained into the schooling. It's kind of in the air that we breathe. It's part of the lingo, this understanding, this underlying principle of the heritage of Western civilization. And that lends to, on this one hand, this plurality, if you will, but true harmony, ethnic and religious harmony. But on the other hand, one thing you'll notice about the Catholic faith as it exists there, and even the Protestant faith, is that it's not syncretistic. You often find that in nations where there is religious pluralism, syncretism just bleeds in. It becomes part of the air that you breathe. But that doesn't seem to be the case in Singapore.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And Cardinal Goh himself has spoken, I know, publicly about the importance of being faithful to what we believe. Mm-hmm. And that commitment to orthodoxy, I think, is one of the things, too, that helps to create such a healthy church.
Right.
And you can also see his great concerns with the inroads and the threat of relativism and secularism, especially mm-hmm. among young people. Mm-hmm. So Singapore has that fascinating combination of the richness of very traditional ancient Asian cultures, but at mm-hmm. the same time, it is very much I hate to use the term, but it is a first world country. And in that sense, too, there's a great concern for young people that they are being influenced by Western media, by wokeism. That's a word I've actually heard quite a bit on this trip, mm-hmm. because I hadn't been there for several years because of COVID. But words like wokeism and relativism and even DEI has entered into some of the conversation, and not in a positive sense, let's put it that way, because they're worried about the twofold thing of young people being lured away from family, the stress on family. And I know you can talk about that, the importance of that small community.
Right, right.
But then also losing their way in a secular society that tends to wash away not just the family life, but also great traditions and stability and the kind of moral compass and values that you need to have.
Right, exactly. And for what it's worth, those might be some of the values that become their saving grace, because those values held true to an almost voluntaristic level in most parts of Asia. can sometimes result in, because it's voluntaristic, because it's not held true as if it's thought out, it can hold out to be the final bastions that block from woke ideology and relativistic ideology from permeating the culture.
Right. I mean, one thing, too, that becomes apparent when you spend time there, it's a Confucian trait, it is a Taoist trait of filial piety, mm-hmm. of the recognition of the importance of honoring the elderly,
right.
of honoring family, but especially the generations in family. And mm-hmm. I think that's going to be one of the messages that Pope Francis brings to Asia, to salute so much of Asia for this dedication to family life, traditional family life, but also here we are, we're talking in the news about World Grandparents Day for Pope Francis, mm-hmm. that he has talked about the need for that bridge always to exist among the generations, but especially between the old and the young, and to cherish grandparents. And that's something that you do very much see in a place like Singapore. You still see it, of course, in parts of China and elsewhere mm-hmm. in Asia, the respect that is paid to the elderly, and they are not considered a throwaway part of society, as right. you use that phrase that Pope Francis likes to. And that's something, too, I think that the West has forgotten and can relearn from a place like Singapore.
Right, especially given our penchant for utilitarian ideologies in the culture. The throwaway culture exists because there's no utility to that subset of the culture. And it, the elderly, but also those who can fall into the categories of abortion, euthanasia, assisted suicide, it's because they serve no either fiscal or just practical purpose within the culture. But this kind of filial piety is kind of ingrained into mm-hmm. quite a lot of Asia. Actually, yeah, most of Asia, as far as I've traveled and lived in, it seems to be part of the culture. It's in the water.
Right. And you see that as a real stabilizing influence. You can see it among young people. I have a chance when I'm visiting there to meet with a lot of different generations, mm-hmm. From the very elderly to the young, and to talk with them about family life. And that's something that is very heartening.
So my guest is Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News and Senior Fellow at St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. Stay tuned as we continue the conversation of current events in the church and in the world and how that pertains to our faith. I'm Marcus Peter, filling in for Al Cresta on Cresta in the Afternoon. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. Marcus Peter here, talking with Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News, Senior Fellow at the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology, and we are talking about current events and how they pertain to our faith. So, Matthew, I will say this. I did not expect, I was told that you had just gotten back from Singapore nearly 5 minutes before the segment began, so I didn't expect that we would wind up talking about the cultural and in this case, the faith milieu in Singapore. But I want to put a bow on the conversation by asking your input on this. Given that we are living in a post-Christian era in the Western Hemisphere, there's mm-hmm. been a lot of talk about how it really is the Southern and then the Eastern Hemisphere who would re-evangelize. The seeds that were planted by the West would then re-evangelize the West again. And we might be seeing quite a lot of it.
Yeah, I agree. I think as we look at the statistics that are put out every year by the Holy See, where the church is growing the most, there are two obvious areas. The first is Africa, which is witnessing titanic growth mm-hmm. in the number of Catholics, but also the number of vocations right. to the priesthood and to men and women religious.
Yeah, the seminaries are running out of room.
Well, precisely. But then we also have in Asia, phenomenal growth. Now, it's deceptive in a way because the growth of the Catholic population across Asia, while very significant, remains still a tiny percentage mm-hmm. of the wider Asian population. So you can have millions of Catholics, tens of millions of Catholics in India, and yet that still seems very insignificant, relatively speaking, to the near billion population inhabitants of India.
Right.
Similarly, in China, you can have tens of millions of Christians, but again, you're talking about another population of about 1 billion people. Having said that, we are witnessing, before our very eyes, the emergence of that vibrant Christian Catholic community across Asia. We always have to be very careful about these broad sweeping generalizations.
Mm-hmm.
But at the pace it's going, and this is why I think the Chinese government, that the communist regime is so concerned about, that you could have in not too many years, China, despite all the persecution, turning into one of the largest, numerically at least, Christian countries in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that tells you something. But then when we also look at the strategy of Pope Francis, and there very much is one, we can talk about the controversy of the deal that was made with China on trying to regularize the appointment of bishops, which is far removed from formal diplomatic relations or even any sort of a concordat.
Mm-hmm.
But Pope Francis has made it a point of his pontificate, A, because he has a longstanding fascination with Asia. He wanted to be a missionary, in fact. But the other is that he sees that the building of resources and strengthening of the church across Asia as central key to the stability of the church in this new century and in this relatively young millennium,
mm-hmm.
which is why he's made visits to places like Myanmar and to far-flung corners of Asia like Mongolia,
right.
with tiny, tiny Catholic populations. But he's still making a statement about Christianity in that part of the world.
Right, which is all crucial. It truly is wonderful, too, because wherever the Judeo-Christian framework, the Catholic faith has gone, it has also brought with it the greatness of Western heritage, intellectual thought, the best of especially Hellenistic philosophy. And all of that has served to not only better the culture there, better life there. On a general perspective, too, it has served to foster a greater understanding of the preservation of the common good for the international whole.
Yes, and a respect for human rights and the concept of a stable government, of
right.
a strong education, of having inherent rights of religious freedom and freedom of speech and other things.
Mm-hmm.
In a place like Singapore, for example, the influence of the English is more than simply the Raffles Hotel, which is the famous landmark, as you know. It is that handing on of some of these key traditions. And
right,
I know
right.
that you grew up with that, and you're a major advocate for that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I didn't get the reference. I mean, yeah, I know the Raffles Hotel. What do you mean by that? But
well, it's sort of an icon of the British colonial era.
Right. No, I got that part. But
right.
like you said, Malaysia and Singapore completely permeated with the best that British civilization had to offer. And like I've been saying, it's in the air, it's in the water. It's that was my system of education. That's the
yes.
system of government we come to know, British parliamentary system. And because of that, receiving of that heritage means that there really is a bridging between the entirety of Western and Eastern hemispheres.
Right. And why I think the preservation, at least in some form, as we have seen, of the Commonwealth
mm-hmm.
Has been so significant in the era with the genuine decline of the British Empire.
Right.
But that preservation of those ties of that community, although I remember, I think it was one of the prime ministers who was visiting the great meeting of the Commonwealth. He always made the point that it is such an odd title because he said, so many of us do not have much wealth and we don't have much in common.
That's very good. That's very good. I grew up grew up hearing that we are part of the British Commonwealth. You don't even think about that. That's
right.
hilarious. It's very well done. I'm going to be texting my family that today. now, I'd like to pivot the conversation just a little. The Register published an article about the Pew Research that's showing that President Biden is in trouble with Catholic voters. We know that most voters, especially those who are regular mass goers, at least over 50% lean, regardless of ethnicity, they lean Republican or identify with the Republican Party in some regard. So in some way, this isn't too surprising, but there's more here to be talked about.
Yeah, there is. The first is that we take a look at the Pew Research Center, which is one of those historically very reliable sources for examining where we are as a country. They do some fascinating stuff on religion and politics. And so they had a presentation at the Religion News Association, which is a gathering of what it sounds like, journalists who are engaged in religious news and covering religion. The report was Religion and Politics Ahead of the U.S. Elections. Mm-hmm. And what it found is the biggest takeaway is the obvious one, that President Biden, who is struggling for overall job approval, and we can talk about that in a minute, is particularly struggling among Catholics. Right now, about 35% of Catholics have a favorable view of him, while 64% have an unfavorable view of him. In striking contrast, the obvious presumptive presidential nominee for the Republicans, former President Donald Trump, has a favorability rate of 42% among Catholics and 57% hold an unfavorable view. Now, on the one hand, that tells you that neither one of these candidates is particularly popular with Catholics. But I think it comes as a warning sign for the White House dealing with an incumbent president seeking re-election, that his numbers are as bad as they are among Catholics. Now, if we look, though, at a Real Clear Politics, which I always recommend as a go-to source for sort of charting where we are with elections, because they're so good at looking at poll averaging and battleground states and other things. When you look at President Biden's job approval nationally, this is across the board on average, he has a disapproval rate of 56% and an approval rate of around 40%.
Okay.
So Catholics are actually a little more down on him than the average voter, but sort of within the margin of error, they are consistent with other voters. So it raises the fascinating question about, is there such a thing at this point as a Catholic voter? Because you said something that was very important, and that is that you have to break down where Catholics really stand on some of the key issues, such as abortion. And we've also found, too, that things like mass attendance, how often they pray, belief in the real presence can also be key determinants in how a Catholic is likely to vote or not vote.
Right. And even to that regard, we should also say just the level of understanding of moral catechetical framework, the understanding of what is the proportionate hierarchy of moral goods, all of these things actually factor into voting decisions at the end. So I take a look at things like the Pew Survey, and I know they're a reliable organization, but they surveyed 12,000 people for this. How do I become one of the 12,000?
Right. Well, that's always one of the great mysteries of polling. As several pollsters I've gotten to know over the years always say, that it is a science, but it is also very much an art.
Right.
And one or two would say, too, that there's a certain kind of alchemy to some of this in how they do it. Because the question also becomes the format, the methodology is so key. And one of the problems that we've had over the years with pollsters who try to survey Catholics in particular, what do you mean by a Catholic? Because we have Catholics who self-identify, but who very clearly do not adhere to most of the teachings of the Catholic Church. Now, Pew is particularly good because it breaks it down by ethnicity. So, for example, it focuses on white voters, white Catholics, as well as Latino Catholics or Hispanic Catholics. That's one thing we see in this, as is consistent, that about 35% of Hispanic Catholics consider themselves Republican, which is actually a fairly high number. And it's an uptick pretty notable since just 2020. But then it also looks at among Catholics who attend Mass monthly or more often. 61% at this point identify with the Republican Party or lean Republican. And we see significantly here a clear majority, about 67% of white Catholics and 52% of Hispanic Catholics lean Republican.
Right.
So the one thing that we can also add to this, and this is important as we look at polling writ large, that we are seeing culturally that those who are believers, so to speak, that those who are active in their faith, regardless of that faith, those who tend to be more active in their faith are much more likely to lean to one political party than the other.
Right, exactly. I'm talking to Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News and Senior Fellow at the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. And we're talking about news and current events as they relate to our faith. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter, filling in for Al Cresta on Cresta in the Afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter, filling in for Al Cresta. My guest, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News and Senior Fellow at the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. And we are talking about news and current events as they relate to our faith. So, Matthew, we were talking earlier about President Biden's popularity amongst Catholic voters, seeing a significant dip. And this speaks to, as you mentioned, not only a trend as to how Catholic voters are reflecting what's happening in the non-religious sphere, so to speak, of the rest of the country. It also speaks to how we understand what makes a Catholic voter a Catholic voter.
Right. And that's been one of the challenges for pollsters for a long time. When we have seen polls in the past, and they always talk about why you have to get into the hard details of a poll, the background data and all of that material of how they went about deciding who is a Catholic voter.
Right.
Because one thing that we've also found in EWTN News over the years has done a number of polls trying to survey the Catholic voter, because it's important for us to be able to understand where Catholic voters are and what they're thinking and what this tells us about us as a Catholic Church in the United States, is that if you have a self-identifying Catholic, but in fact they do not attend Mass, they don't really believe in the real presence, they never go to confession, and they disagree with the Church on almost every major issue, from abortion and euthanasia to contraception, and of course now you have to factor in all of the questions of LGBTQ and transgender and gender ideology, as Pope Francis calls it. Those are key markers, and they also are indicators of how someone is likely to vote, whether they're Catholic or not. Then we have the added complication of a president who is a Catholic, who is a self-avowed Catholic, and certainly his spokespeople always reiterate that they stress that that President Biden is a, quote, practicing Catholic. I've heard phrases used in secular media that he's a devout Catholic. At the same time, he holds positions that are directly contrary to the teachings of the Church. And the Archbishop of Washington, Cardinal Wilton Gregory, himself just recently said that he described President Biden as what is traditionally known as a cafeteria Catholic. So again, we suffer in many ways in polling and in obvious other ways in trying to identify what exactly is a Catholic voter. And it's a challenge.
And I mean, especially when you consider that President Biden and his spokespersons wears his quote-unquote Catholic faith on his sleeve, so to speak. He's identified with it constantly. He recently made the sign of the cross in response to pro-abortion comments made by Nikki Fried, who, and she, you know, Nikki was standing next to the president. You look at situations like this, and you see more and more that the Catholic faith in the public sphere is being brought into proximity with the very things that, and take the politics outside of the issue on a moral perspective. These are the very things that the church has vehemently stood against because they are contradictory to the gospel of Jesus Christ and divine revelation.
Right.
So, tell us more about that.
And we can, we just don't want to focus exclusively on President Biden. Mm-hmm. He is the most well-known now American Catholic. Mm-hmm. It makes it very clear that he is a Catholic, but he's not singularly unique.
Right.
In being a Catholic politician who also holds positions that are very contrary to the teachings of the church. I think especially of former Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. There are many others in the Senate, and we can say on both sides of the aisle, who also hold positions that are very opposed to the teachings of the church.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the restatement, and I think this is why this new declaration, Dignitas Infinita, was so important.
Right.
A restatement of what the church believes on so many of these key social issues today. So in this statement, this declaration from the Dicastery of the Doctrine of the Faith, we have a reiteration of the church's teachings on abortion and euthanasia, as well as gender ideology and sex change. And that reference then gives us additional clarity in how we assess different politicians.
Mm-hmm.
I don't sit in judgment of President Biden in that sense, mm-hmm. of that I understand he considers himself to be a man of faith. And at the same time, however, we do have to point out as journalists that he holds positions that are very different from the teachings of the church.
Mm-hmm. Right, and these are crucial things for us to consider when making informed moral decisions of our voting choices. Now, because you mentioned the DDF, this is a good time to pivot the subject. And this is pretty good news, actually, that Cardinal Fernandez announced that a new document on discerning apparitions is being finalized. So let's touch on this in an overarching perspective, and then let's talk about the re-release of the document that disavows the mediatrics of All Grace apparition in the Philippines.
Yeah, well, it's been a remarkable journey with Cardinal Fernandez since his appointment as the head of the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that because he really has been incredibly active in pushing ahead with new documents and with declarations and other things since his appointment.
Right.
Now, we can think, of course, of fiducia supplicans that allowed for, at least opened the door for, as they always stress, non-liturgical, simple, and spontaneous blessings of couples in irregular situations and same-sex couples. But given that we have the reaction to that, and that was then followed by, as we were just talking, Dignitas Infinita. So he has managed within the space of less, what, 6, 7, 8 months now,
mm-hmm.
to pack, if you go to the homepage of the Dicastery of the Doctrine of the Faith and you look at statements and releases, he has issued more documents just since his arrival than probably in the last 6 or 7 years by that dicastery. I say all of this by way of providing a little bit of context that we have yet another statement that is apparently coming out. This is thanks to the reporting of Edward Penton at the National Catholic Register.
Right.
That there is going to be a new document on discerning apparitions and how those are then assessed. And what they're trying to do is to provide clear guidelines and norms, quote, for the discernment of apparitions and other phenomena. And I think that you seem well disposed to having a document on like this, because we haven't really seen anything like this for quite a few years. I think you have to go all the way back to the late end period of the pontificate of Pope St. Paul VI,
mm-hmm.
since we've had anything along those lines that provides that sort of clarity.
Right. And so at the core of this, it could well be that driven by the initiative of Pope Francis, the DDF does want to, in fact, bring about some clarity of ongoing apparitions that are presently happening in the world right now, but as well as, I mean, I can't call them apparitions if they've not been approved, so alleged apparitions,
right.
As well as ones that allegedly took place in the past, and just to make sure that there's concrete didactic clarity coming from the Vatican's office about these things and as to whether they're worthy of veneration, which, again, you know, that kind of clarity is a good thing for the development of the spirituality of the children of the Church.
That's right. And to have that rightful authority weighing in on this is crucial, I think,
mm-hmm.
In part because we, as you know, popular piety is an important thing, but we also have to have clarity about whether or not an alleged apparition is legitimate.
Right.
And it's also important, I think, for Catholics to understand what private revelations are, and how that understanding then can inform us in our faith life, but not to confuse such things with the teachings of the Church.
Right. So I just want to share this, just having come from a formerly Pentecostal background where private revelations were all elevated to the level of the inspiration of the gospel because we didn't have a proper notion of what was inspired and what wasn't. You frequently saw this overvalidation of visions and apparitions, if you can call them that. So having this magisterial certitude is one of the main reasons why I love being Catholic, and it's something to be
yes,
it's something to be truly grateful for. So and touching on this, then last month the DDF released this, and it's in inverted commas here. Penton put it in inverted commas. This decree, long hidden from the 1951 declaration, which had announced that the 1948 apparition in the Philippines of Our Lady Mediatrix of All Grace was not, in fact, supernatural. Now, I've got a small personal vested interest in this. When I was in the Philippines for 2 years, I was actually in Lipa Batangas. That's where we lived.
Mm-hmm.
That was where my seminary was. And
yeah,
there's this underlying almost anger toward the Vatican for not announcing approval of that apparition. And the claim amongst the people was that the Vatican was afraid that announcing that would mean that the Philippines would become the new Vatican of the East or whatever. But
right.
So it's a little funny because, like we mentioned, popular piety, right? But just comment on all of that and why this announcement is so good.
Well, it's good because I think it hopefully brings some conclusion to what has been a controversial subject.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we know this is a side story here, but we do have things like, I believe it's pronounced the Aglipayan Schism, or Schism,
mm-hmm.
In the Philippines. So there is a background of difficulties. And so I think a decree like this, late as it might be, stressing again, this is from 1951,
right.
Reinforces the importance of having rightful authorities judging what is and what is not a valid apparition. And in that sense, too, and this is where I think the accompanying decree from Cardinal Fernandez, that in this case, he noted how Mother Mary Cecilia of Jesus of the Discalced Carmelite Convent had, as he writes in 1951, confessed to having deceived the faithful about the alleged apparitions,
right,
and consequently asked for forgiveness. So this is a good example of how this sort of transparency, even if it comes decades later, can help to settle what have been tortured historical questions,
mm-hmm.
and can help people moving forward as to why it makes sense to have this type of authority.
I mean, and this clarity is crucial because a Dominican exorcist priest was sued in the Philippines for
yes.
offending religious feelings for calling the apparitions, for discrediting the apparitions.
Right. And that's where, too, that type of earnest but misguided fervor can create many problems and severe division within the Church. And we're seeing polarization at times within the Church and division within the Church. I think, for example, of the very sad situation that we're facing right now in the diocese of Fort Worth, I think, in Texas.
Yeah, Texas.
With this ongoing drama, as I call it, involving a Texas community of cloistered nuns who are now asking a judge to grant a restraining order against the Vatican in this situation. So it's important to have unity as a church, and I think that's where rightful authority is so crucial.
Amen. Well, thank you for joining us, Matthew. I've been talking to Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News and Senior Fellow at St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. I'm Marcus Peter, filling in for Al Cresta on Cresta in the afternoon.